We're going to, since it's been so long, we're going to look at 2 Samuel 3 tonight. I don't know how much of 3 we did, if we did any. I don't remember, but it's been so long that we'll go back and do 3 tonight, and Lord willing, we'll do 4 next Wednesday. This chapter has to do with personal vendettas. It has to do with revenge. But there's also some lessons about diplomacy in it. It always gets me when people talk about the Old Testament and say there's nothing to learn. Man, there's something to learn in every chapter you find in the Old Testament. There are some great, great lessons. And we'll kind of see tonight in how to handle certain types of situations, and then also how not to handle certain types of situations. So it's, you know, even though these things happened 3,000 or 4,000 years ago, it doesn't take away from the fact that they're still relevant because people act today just like they did from the very beginning. So they have the same temptations, they have the same emotions and feelings, and so we can, I think, learn a great deal from it. Would someone begin by reading the first 5 verses? And don't worry, of course, about the pronunciation of the words because no one really knows how they were pronounced anyway. So 2 Samuel chapter 3, the first 5 verses.
Now there was long war between the house of Saul and the house of David. But David waxed stronger and stronger, and the house of Saul waxed weaker and weaker. And unto David were sons born in Hebron. And his firstborn was Amnon of Ahinoam and Jezreelitis. And his second, Chilion of Abigail, the wife of Nabal the Carmelite. And the third, Absalom, the son of Maacah, the daughter of Talmai, king of Geshur. And the fourth, Adonijah, the son of Haggith. And the fifth, Shephathiah, the son of Manasseh. And the sixth, Ephraim, by Eglah, David's wife, these were born to David in Hebron.
Now, even though that's a lot about different people and things, there's a great lesson in those first 5 verses. I mean, there are 2 great lessons. The first lesson comes from the very first verse where it talks about there was a long war. Now, this is what we would call a civil war, isn't it? Because this is between family. These are all family. These are blood relation. And they were continuing this battle, killing each other. But yet they were all related. So civil wars have been going on a long, long time. Like I said, this goes back several thousand years. So that is nothing, you know, new, that there are civil wars. And this one in particular, it talks about, of course, is between Saul and David. And it says during this time, all these battles that went on during this war, that during that period of time, David and his army became a lot stronger, whereas Saul's became weaker and weaker. Then the next 4 verses talks about all these different sons of David. What do we learn in those 4 verses that we haven't known before? Pardon?
Didn't he have any daughters?
Okay. That wasn't what I was getting at, but that's I hadn't even thought of that. what did we find here? What do we find that about David that we didn't know? What?
He's got quite a few wives.
He's got quite a few wives, right? Now, we had known about a couple, right, before this. But now we see that he's got a bunch more. Okay? Now, a lot of times, really even up until probably the early 1900s, what was one of the reasons for a lot of these types of marriages? What were they used for?
Alliances.
Alliances, right. Yeah. Alliances. You know, you go back to the 1700s and 1800s, especially in Europe, and you see, you know, different families marrying each other, you know, to the boys and girls so that there can be alliances. Okay, that might be part of what was going on back at this time when you see there's quite a variety of wives as far as where they came from in this. And he talks about one being the Jezreelitess, one from that came from a Carmelite, one came from the king of Geshur. Some of the others we really don't know, but we do know where they were born. They were all born there to David and Hebron. So these might have been political alliances. Now, what does this begin to tell us about something that happens in David's life? What do we start to see that's one of David's problems? And this kind of sets the tone for some of the things. Isn't this one of his weaknesses? It really was. It was one of his weaknesses. And that was passed on, wasn't it? Passed on to other generations. So, you know, we see something, I don't know if you want to say developing, but we see something in David's character, a weakness in his character that would continue to bother him in his life in different ways. Okay. Exactly. The next generation did exactly the same thing, but even probably to a greater extent when we'll get, you know, when we get to Solomon. Yeah. I don't know. Right. I don't know if there is any. I didn't. The sources I read didn't mention that being any different. I don't know. I really don't know if there was any significance. You know what? I don't know. There may have been. But I think we can see that, you know, David's going to reap what he sows, I guess, is what we're getting at. He's going to reap what he sows by all of these different wives. And then, of course, there's always jealousies and there's, you know, one hating the other one and all kinds of problems that develop when you do this. Now, God allowed that, but he didn't like it, right? Remember, we go back to the law of Moses and, you know, the Old Testament, it talks about how God allowed it, but that wasn't what he wanted, right? That wasn't his plan. Yeah, it wasn't his plan. And when people get away from it, even though he allowed it, it caused problems, yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yep. Yep. Absolutely. He said it would happen, and it did happen. Let me go back and check something real quick. I don't remember what this verse says, and if it doesn't have anything significant, then I'll just pretend like there was nothing there. Oh, okay, here we go. Yeah, it's very relevant. I'm glad. Let's go back to Deuteronomy 17 for a moment. Deuteronomy 17. And if you have a heading under verse 14 or on before verse 14, it has to do with principles governing kings. Principles governing kings. Deuteronomy 17. And notice what verse 17 says. Deuteronomy 17:17. It says, "Neither shall he," referring to the king, "multiply wives for himself, lest his heart turn away." And that really happened with Solomon to a great degree. So, going back to the law of Moses, they were specifically told, kings, don't multiply wives because look what's going to happen. And kind of like what David mentioned, it happened exactly like God said it would happen. So whenever God, you know, gives us principles, you know, he gives us the best. This is the best way to live your life. You get away from that, you're bringing yourself troubles. You're just going to cause heartbreak and suffering and everything else. So David will, because of his poor decisions, now they may have been good political decisions in his mind, but, you know, in the long run, he ended up definitely reaping the whirlwind, like the Bible talks about, from what he would sow. So, you know, we just look at those five verses, and it would be so easy to just kind of go through them real quick and say this, that, and the other. But there's a lot in there that teaches us some great lessons. It really does. Teaches us some lessons about, again, you know, situations and what to avoid and how to handle things. And this next section does the same thing. Let's begin. Let's read verses 6 through 11. Would someone now read the next, what's that, six verses? 6 through 11.
As the war between the house of Saul and the house of David went on, Abner became a powerful leader among those loyal to Saul. One day, Ishbosheth, Saul's son, accused Abner of sleeping with one of his father's concubines, a woman named Rizpah, daughter of Aiah. Abner was furious. "Am I some Judean dog to be kicked around like this?" he shouted. "After all I have done for your father, Saul, and his family and friends by not handing you over to David. Is this my reward, that you find fault with me about this woman? May God strike me and even kill me if I don't do everything I can to help David get what the Lord has promised him. Am I going to take Saul's kingdom and give it to David? Or I'm going to take Saul's kingdom, throne, and give it over to David. I will establish the throne of David over Israel as well as Judah, all the way from Dan in the north to Beersheba in the south." Ishbosheth didn't dare say another word because he was afraid of what Abner might do.
Okay. Again, we have some, you know, some lessons from this that we can bring right over into our present day. There is, we might call this some political maneuvering, because that's what was happening. And I know it's hard to believe there's still political maneuvering that goes on today. But that's what's going on thousands of years ago. Political maneuvering. That's what Abner's doing. He is making sure there's a place for himself in the future. He's kind of playing a game. So during this time when the war is going on, here's Abner is strengthening his hold. Okay, he's strengthening his hold. He has a game that he wants to play. You know, he wants to make sure that Abner, regardless of what happens either way, that Abner is taken care of. So Abner was concerned about Abner. And he wanted to make sure that he was in good shape someday. And he knew how to play, you might say, both sides against the middle. He was very good at that type of political maneuvering. So there's an accusation, I guess we would call it, made. Ishbosheth is the one that accuses him. "Why have you gone into my father's concubine?" Now, of course, the king, when his concubines were like property. So if you went into a king's concubine, that was like stealing. And you could, you know, suffer greatly at the hands of the king. So anyone that would do that would be very presumptuous. And that's why he's responding like that. "So why did you do this? Why did you go into my father's concubine?" And so Abner comes back and it says he's very angry. Okay, he's very angry. Probably for a number of reasons, but he's very angry. You know, he says, "Am I a dog's head?" Now, I don't know if you've seen, I have the two cutest dogs in America at my house, and they're just sweet little things. But in Palestine and during these times, dogs were they were bad. You know, dogs were not pets. Dogs were not anything anybody would want. You know, they were scavengers. They were filthy, nasty animals. And so when he uses that phrase, you know, he's basically saying, "Am I just some old dog? Am I just some old, like a rat?" I mean, we'd almost call it. You know, "Am I some old rat? by you saying that, because he said, I'm showing loyalty to the house of Saul, your father. And he said, I haven't delivered you into the hand of David, and you're charging me with this? It's like, how dare you accuse me? You know, how could you possibly, you know, make those type of accusations? It's almost saying that, you know, I'm above the law. Don't you dare say that I've done anything wrong. I can, you know, do whatever I want. I'm the real power behind the throne, is kind of what he's saying. Ishbosheth knows that he isn't. And so Abner is, like it says, he's trying to strengthen and make himself the real power. And what Abner, of course, is doing is very wrong and at lots of different levels. So he makes this kind of oath where he says, you know, may God do to me and more if I don't do for David as the Lord has sworn to him, to transfer the kingdom from the house of Saul and set up the throne of David over Israel and over Judah from Dan to Beersheba. And whatever the Old Testament typically uses Dan to Beersheba, they're talking about, you know, the whole kingdom from one end to the other. So, and that's the, and that translation pointed that out from, you know, Dan in the north all the way to Beersheba in the south. So from one extreme to the other. And Ishbosheth couldn't answer him. Okay, he again knew that Abner was way more powerful than Ishbosheth was. So he wasn't saying anything, he wasn't going to do anything, regardless of how wrong Abner was. You know, he wasn't going to say any more against him. So then, more lessons to be learned, beginning in verse 12. Then Abner sent messengers on his behalf to David, saying, "Whose is the land? Saying also, make your covenant with me, and indeed my hand shall be with you to bring all Israel to you." There's some more of the political maneuvering. Let's join hands. You know, basically he's saying, I'm the one that's over Saul and his throne, so why don't we, you know, join hands with David with basically the two tribes in the south and Saul with the northern tribes. Let's bring all of this together and we'll have one great big united kingdom. So again, he's maneuvering. And I guess you want to call it negotiating, whatever, but that's what he's doing. And David says, good, I will make a covenant with you, but one thing I require of you, you shall not see my face unless you first bring Michal, Saul's daughter, when you come to see my face. And remember, that was his wife. But she was taken away from him quite some time ago. But he says that has to happen first. So David sent messengers to Ishbosheth, Saul's son, saying, give me my wife Michal, whom I betrothed to myself, for 100 foreskins of the Philistines. And remember, he was constantly in battle with them in different areas. And Ishbosheth sent and took her from her husband, from Paltiel, the son of Laish. Then her husband went along with her to Baharim, weeping behind her. So Abner said to him, go, return. And he returned. He probably understood that Abner was like the leader of Saul's northern tribe. So he didn't want to. But of course, he really didn't have a right to her in the first place, because she was actually David's wife. So now Abner had communicated with the elders of Israel, saying, in time past you were seeking for David to be king over you. Now then, do it. For the Lord has spoken of David, saying, by the hand of my servant David I will save my people Israel from the hand of the Philistines and the hand of all their enemies. And when he's talking about Israel there, he's talking about primarily the northern tribes, because they were the ones that were basically with Saul, whereas the southern tribes were with David. So he says, do it. This is what God has spoken. So do it. Kind of interesting when you see what he says during these conversations. He makes me think of somebody who's the wheels in his mind are constantly going and going and going. trying to think about what is ending up going to be the best for him. He seems to be very concerned about himself and where he's going to end up. Almost like he's showing David a favor. So I'll do a favor for you, David. Even though Abner had no right to anything. So he says, and Abner also spoke in the hearing of Benjamin. Then Abner also went to speak in the hearing of David and Hebron, all that seemed good to Israel and the whole house of Benjamin. So Abner and 20 men with him came to David at Hebron, and David made a feast for Abner, and the men were with him. Then Abner said to David, I will arise and go and gather all Israel to my lord the king, that they may make a covenant with you, and that you may reign over all that your heart desires. So David sent Abner away, and he went in peace. Nowhere in this, of course, do we see Abner in any way saying that he had done anything wrong. Again, I think that's part of the political maneuvering. Nowhere does he ever say or even hint that he's ever done anything wrong or underhanded or out of line or anything else. Many people have learned from him through the ages, apparently, how to never admit that they've done a single thing wrong. I think something we can learn from David is, you know, he never tried to force himself over Israel. You know, Judah, the southern part, they were with him, but even though God had anointed him over the whole kingdom, he never tried to, militarily or any other way, try and force himself on the northern tribes. He never did that. And I think that's something to be said for him. He certainly had his faults, but I think he was doing what was right here. All right. At that moment, the servants of David and Joab came from a raid and brought much spoil with them. But Abner was not with David in Hebron, for he had sent him away and he had gone in peace. When Joab, remember that was David's head military guy. When Joab and all the troops that were with him had come, they told Joab, saying, Abner the son of Ner came to the king and he sent him away and he's gone in peace. And I imagine that's probably how it was said too, just like that. Can you believe what David did? He sent him away in peace. Then Joab came to the king and said, what have you done? Look, Abner came to you. Why is it that you sent him away and he's already gone? Why didn't you kill him? That's what he's wanting to know. Why didn't you kill him? Surely you realize that Abner the son of Ner came to deceive you, to know you're going out and you're coming in and to know all that you are doing. Why in the world did you do that, David? I mean, that's what he's saying. He's basically saying, David, you're naive. You're naive to think that Abner is going to do anything he says he's going to do. Now, so Joab, when Joab had gone from David's presence, he sent messengers after Abner who brought him back from the well of Sirah, but David did not know it. Now, when Abner had returned to Hebron, Joab took him aside in the gate to speak with him privately, and there stabbed him in the stomach, so that he died for the blood of Azahel, his brother. And remember, Azahel was the one that chased Abner, and Abner tried to tell him, you know, turn away, don't continue on, but he continued on anyway, and so ended up killing him. But that was in war. I mean, that was during a battle. Whereas this was just plain old revenge. And what made it worse was Hebron was one of the cities of refuge, where he had definitely no right to do that. So he kind of did, he doubled up on his wrongs here. Joab did, because he had no right in any circumstance to do that. And of course, David, I'm sure, when he finds out, believes that, you know, this could jeopardize peace. You know, when they find out that Joab killed Abner, well, then they could go back to having civil wars again. So something that he, you know, should have been concerned about. So,
did David know that? Did David know that Ashishel was killed? Ashishel.
Yeah, he had known that had happened. That was back a few chapters ago. I don't remember exactly when that happened, but excuse me. So here's what happened. Our time's about run out, but. After when David heard it, he said, "My kingdom and I are guiltless before the Lord forever of the blood of Abner, the son of Ner." So he wants it known that he had nothing to do with Abner's death. He didn't condone it. He didn't tell Joab to do it. So he says, "Let it rest on the head of Joab and on all his father's house, and let there never fail to be in the house of Joab one who has a discharge or who's a leper, who leans on a staff or falls by the sword, or who lacks bread." So Joab and Abishai, his brother, killed Abner because he had killed their brother Asahel at Gibeon in the battle. So David curses Joab's family and descendants that at all times they would have at least one of these five different things. You know, be a leper or they go hungry or have a discharge or whatever. So, well, Lord willing, we'll finish chapter 3 next week and go on into chapter 4 where we see a murder take place. The lesson we saw tonight that I think really applies to the Christian age a lot is that David, when there were problems between the northern and southern parts of the kingdom, and the southern kingdom, Benjamin and Judah were following him, and the northern tribes were still kind of unsure. David never tried to force them in any way to follow him. And that idea is brought over into the New Testament. You know, some religions today force people to become followers, to be disciples or whatever. But Christianity never does that. It's a free will decision. There's never a coercion, or there's never, you know, there's no prize held out there for people to grab on and to try and get people into the kingdom. Because Jesus knew that the only kind of people that he wanted in the kingdom were people who chose that. And at the very end of the Bible, in Revelation 22, beginning in verse 12, "And behold, I am coming quickly, and my reward is with me," this is the words of Jesus, "to give to everyone according to his work. I'm the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end, the first and the last." Then in verse 16, he says, "I, Jesus, have sent my angel to testify to you these things in the churches. I'm the root and the offspring of David, the bright and morning star. And the Spirit and the bride say, 'Come.' And let him who hears say, 'Come.' And let him who thirsts, 'Come, whoever desires, let him take the water of life freely.'" Four times in verse 17, there's the idea of being invited. If you desire, come. If you want to, come. If you want to have life, come. But there is never any type of coercion. Even when Jesus, many of his disciples, you know, they followed him for a long time to get the bread and see the miracles and get healed. And then when it got to the point in his ministry when it became more difficult, a lot of those people, a lot of those disciples left. And Jesus never one time went to them and tried to drag them back. He was all about free will and having decisions to, you know, you can either follow him or you can refuse to reject him. He is not going to coerce you or force you to do any of those things. And that's just as true today. You know, those who come to the kingdom, those who come to Christ, do so freely. Not because there's some sort of monetary reward or some sort of powerful position or anything else. They come to him because of who he is. You know, he's the Lord and Savior. And so when we talk about an invitation, that's why we call it that, because Christ is inviting people to make the decision to either become a New Testament Christian or to confess wrongs and ask for forgiveness. So it's all about the ability we have to make decisions and to make the right choice. So as Travis leads us in this invitation song, we need to think about, as you know, Christ is inviting us. He's saying, come. He's saying, if you desire, come. If you want life, come. So let's stand and sing this song. If you have the desire, we encourage you to come.